Why I'm half naked.
It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning. Welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford. I'm your host this morning. This is Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, we're going to be talking about technology in the federal government. We've got some real cutting-edge discussion in store for you. And to help us with our discussion from Cisco, I'd like to welcome John Carney. John, welcome to Fed Talk.
Thank you, Bill.
And also Tim Simon. Tim, welcome to Fed Talk. Tim, are you there? Okay, Tim is calling into the show. John is in the studio. John has over 25 years of experience in the IT community and works with Cisco, helping Cisco with its government side of business, and is a security and IT expert, but also works with Cisco to help government with its business solutions. Tim Simon will be with us in just a moment. Tim is a veteran of the public sector technology marketplace, and one of the things about Tim is he's been a telecommuter since 1997. So later on in the show, we're going to talk a lot about the technology aspects of telecommuting. And before we get started, I would like to remind our listeners that Fed Talk is brought to you by GEICO. Go to geico.com where you can save, where 15 minutes can save you 15% on car insurance. If you'd like to join us today, if you'd like to talk about our topic, technology in the federal government, please give us a call at 1-877-936-9333. That's a toll-free number. Or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. Tim, are you there?
I sure am. How are you doing, Bill?
Good. Welcome to Fed Talk. It's good to have you here.
Thanks.
I'm looking forward to a little bit later. We're going to be talking about telecommuting and your experiences with your 14 years as a telecommuter. You're a real pioneer there.
Great.
So before we get into that, I would like to talk a little bit just about Cisco. I think it's a very common name. Everybody's heard about it. But tell us what Cisco does. Tim, why don't we start with you?
Well, I think, you know, most folks think of Cisco as being the the power behind the internet, the core routing and switching, the people that connect folks, and or the plumbers, if you will, and that's kind of good. But you know, we do a whole lot more than that. You know, from video to data, of course, to voice communications and collaboration. So we really span the entire breadth of the IT infrastructure today. You know, we are probably fortunate to be. The leading force in networking, and we're also very involved in cybersecurity with federal government.
And a very, very important force in the internet in general, which of course has become indispensable to life in these times. John, tell us a little bit about what Cisco's work with the federal government.
Well, first and foremost, I think Cisco. I think of Cisco as an innovator. We are large in the core routing and switching areas, but over and above that, we try to look at what are the business issues that people are having today. And rather than just trying to apply a technology, trying to sell a technology, we try to solve the business problems using technology.
Can you talk a little bit about those business problems? I mean, how do you figure out what the business problems are when you're essentially an IT company?
Well, we have some of our groups, some of our departments are organized by verticals. And so what we do is we bring people in that actually have vertical relevance, that have come from a government background or come from a public sector background, that have worked in the industry or that work with the industry, that really do understand what the business problems are and have been around for a long enough time that they can help to help us to understand what those are.
And Tim, one of the things I understand you have quite a background in is the whole idea of e-government. And I think people sort of understand what that means these days, but why don't you talk about it from your perspective? You probably saw it grow from almost nothing to where it's now a central part of a lot of what government does.
Well, yeah, you know, so I think if you look back at the e-government Act of 2002, you know, we saw the beginnings, and we saw, you know, the role and the change and the impetus that, you know, came out of Clinger-Cohen wanting us to have a more agile and defined IT environment for government that was, you know, going to be responsive from a business standpoint. There was a demand certainly for more citizen services. I think you saw that specifically at the state and local level. You know, things like, you know, people were getting fed up with the long waits at for things like at DMV.
You're like getting your driver's license. Yes, I noticed I can do that online now.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, the same thing with federal services. You know, we wanted, you know, if you wanted to find out information about a national park, you know, you didn't want to have to write away for the information. You wanted to be able to go online and be able to make your reservations, et cetera. So the, certainly the customer impetus was there from citizens. I think also, you know, the idea of being able to deliver better services and to have more real-time information for our warfighter was increasingly important. And of course, we all know the need for e-government when it comes to national security and you know, protecting our national assets. So I think the impetus, you know, from my standpoint and, you know, from an outside, you know, from the vendor community looking in was, you know, government wanting to have better ways to communicate with their stakeholders and among themselves and find ways that they could do that without breaking the bank. You know, and you know, it's really been a kind of a fun roller coaster to see how we've solved some of those problems over the years.
So it didn't just start in 2002, though, did it? Because I remember back in the 1980s, the IRS having some significant challenges with trying to computerize tax records, and so it's been around a long time. What was it about 2002 that really made it different, or perhaps spurred it on?
Well, you know, I guess that was. Probably, Mark Forman coming into the White House, and looking at how you took a business angle on running government from OMB. At least that was my perspective. That government took a hard look at the business processes and how corporations were managing data and communications, and tried to then model. Back that success into government.
So, John, can you talk a little bit about what you see the big trends in government now with IT, the big challenges?
Well, I think some of the challenges that are out there, one of the big ones is the outdated technologies that have been around for a long time.
Now, how long is a long time these days? I know I've been told I have to get a new computer every 3 or 4 years.
Well, yeah, 3 or 4 years is a long time, is an eternity these days. But you know, there's probably phone systems that are out there that are still 15 to 25 years old, and so, you know, if you look at the voice communications that are out there, if you look at the network communications that are installed, you're probably looking at some stuff that's still, you know, 15 years old, and I think that. That's a huge barrier to being able to adopt some of the newer technologies that are available today. And I think that's where, Cisco becomes the innovator. I think they look at, you know, how do we take people from an older technology and how do we migrate them into a newer environment where they can support voice, video, and data all over the same network.
So old technology, any other major major challenges you see?
Cost and people.
Cost and people.
Money. Yeah, I mean, people.
Money's a big issue for everybody these days, right?
But trying to do more with less, right? Less resources, less people, less money. Trying to do take advantage of what you have, use what's available, and then leverage that as you move forward. And I think that that's one of the places that we can really help is to look at what's in place and not just come in and try to say, you need to do this and replace this today. It's, this is what you can do over the next 5 to 10 years to get you where you need to be. This is what you need to do in the next 6 months. This is what you need to do in the next 6 years.
All right. This is Fed Talk, and we're talking about technology in the federal government with John Carney and Tom Simon from Cisco. And we'll continue our discussion after this short break. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hello, my federal friends. It's the Geico Gecko, and I've got good news for you. I might even say it's some of the best news ever. Okay, well, definitely in the top three. The big news. Geico now offers discounts for most federal employees GS7 or above, which is no doubt a lot of you out there. So you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, all with a company that began over 70 years ago with the sole purpose of serving government employees like yourself. Yeah, that's right. Geico, the government employees insurance company. And today, well, we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. And did you know about Geico's 97% customer satisfaction rate? Well, saving money tends to make people rather happy, I think. So congrats again to those federal employees GS7 or above. Welcome to the Savings Club. Mike?
Got it. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. The Gecko's right. Discounts are available for most federal employees GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
I'm Deborah Roth, host of Fed Talk and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Our firm specializes in helping federal employees with legal issues concerning their jobs or benefits. For 2 decades, we have been representing federal employees in adverse action cases, employment discrimination complaints, inspector general and internal affairs investigations, security clearance issues, and other federal employment disputes. If you have a legal concern, don't wait. Call Shaw, Bransford & Roth at 202-463-8400 or visit our website at shawbransford.com.
You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Bill Bransford, your host, and I'm joined today by John Carney, Senior Manager at Cisco, and Tim Simon, Senior Solutions Marketing Manager at Cisco. We're talking about technology in the federal government. You can join us at in our discussion by calling our toll-free number, 1-877-936-9333, or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. John, it seems to me that one of the big areas that federal agencies have to deal with is cybersecurity. It's always in the news, and I think it's also, a little bit later, we're going to talk about telework, and that's a big issue there as well. So can we talk about how do you do cybersecurity?
Well, it's interesting. Cybersecurity means different things to different people when you come right down to it. When you look at it from the government's perspective, it's more around risk mitigation, right? It's understanding what is, you know, how much risk can we accept, and how do we manage the threat levels? So it's not, you know, it's to an individual, cybersecurity means antivirus and malware, but to the government, it's more about protecting the critical infrastructure and making sure that, you know, if an issue comes
up. It's also about keeping people out, isn't it, who don't need to be in?
Well, it is. It's about keeping people out. But, the one thing that keeps coming up is that there's an assumption that people are going to be in there. So once, you know, you can't keep everybody out. So how much effort do you work on to keep people out, or how much effort do you spend to make sure that you can maintain your business levels once people do get in?
So, Tim, let me ask you a question that I see written down in my notes here about cybersecurity, and that's an acronym that I kind of hear from time to time, and I wonder about it and say, gosh, I need to learn more about that someday, and that's FISMA. Do you know what FISMA is, don't you, Tim?
Sure.
Tell us about FISMA.
Well, F- Federal Information Security Management Act, I think also of 2002. I'm sure that wasn't the first time that information security was addressed by legislation, but that's the main legislation that establishes security standards for government. It's increasingly become important for all federal agencies, of course, but also I think for state and local governments as well, as they qualify for federal grants and for information sharing programs with government. It's the base level security requirements that I think every agency strives for. It used to be that they all got that every agency got a grade on their FISMA compliance. So it is kind of the granddaddy that everybody tries to achieve from a compliance standpoint, and hopefully that compliance will make an agency more secure.
Well, I know that my IT colleagues that are working federal agencies that I talk to from time to time are always worried about their FISMA compliance and whether they're in compliance or not in compliance. So what are some of the things that need to be done to comply with FISMA?
Well, we look at cybersecurity and security in general, you know, in three distinct ways. We look at, you know, what is the trust on the government network? Who is out there? Who's on the network? Who should be on the network? Who shouldn't be on the network? What's the good information that you want to keep in the network? What's the bad information you want to keep out? We look at visibility. We look at how can you see the overall infrastructure. Can you look at the different elements and devices that are accessing government networks? Can you see where the inquiries are coming from? Can you see where where the bad guys are, where they're what holes they're coming through? And then we look at the resilience. How do you respond and keep a system resilient in the face of an attack? So those are three different, you know, kind of views that we have: trust, visibility, and resilience. Then we look at, you know, from a very practical standpoint, three different areas that we look at, you know, trying to work with agencies in terms of mitigation. We look at, you know, can you secure your mobility? You know, in today's world, you know, we have every kind of device in the world coming onto the government networks. So secure mobility is a very important thing. We also then look at, can you secure the crown assets, the crown jewels of the organization, the data center? And then finally, you know, the identity. Are people in devices who they say they are? And can they authenticate and prove who they say they are?
So that sounds like a lot of work to put together this to show that you're in FISMA compliance. Is that something that agencies will hire contractors to help them with?
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, and I think our system integrator friends and the niche security companies and consulting firms around the district, that's a good business for them. And it's an area that I think government needs help in. There's a shortage of trained security personnel. That's something that Cisco works with our high schools around the country, trying to, with our networking academies and with different security organizations, trying to train up folks so that we can meet the needs of this growing requirement for cyber professionals.
So, John, Tim's mentioned this, and I think you mentioned it as well, bad guys. Who are the bad guys that we're trying to deal with from a cybersecurity perspective?
Well, the bad guys have changed over the years. It used to be the high school kids that were writing scripts and trying to break in and hack in to change their school grades or to get online and play games. And now what we're seeing is a much greater threat from around the world. Trying to identify exactly who they are is a difficult proposition, but the threats have become considerably more sophisticated and considerably more targeted. And rather than going after information, what we're seeing is that they're actually going after the critical infrastructure of a government, of a city, of a state, and trying to interrupt the businesses that are happening within that environment.
Actually, bring down that website, that the way that network would operate?
I think it's way beyond just a website. It's actually bringing down the critical infrastructure and the way the business operates.
What does that mean, critical infrastructure, to our non-IT listeners?
The critical infrastructure are the pieces and parts that you use every day to make your business work. So it's not just the computer that's sitting in front of you. It's the entire infrastructure behind it. It's the servers. It's the data center. It's the network. It's the connectivity between Washington, D.C. and New York City, because you've got offices in different places. So it's really trying to make sure that all of the information, that you can get access to the information that you need to get to when you need to get to it.
So when I heard Tim discussing some of the components of FISMA, I heard him mention being able to see or determine who's coming in into your network, into your infrastructure, and yet you, I think, imply that you can't always tell. How do you do that? How do you try to figure out who's coming in?
Well, there's a continuous monitoring is typically the way you would do that, is being able to monitor your network, monitor your resources, and logging the data accesses that happen. So there's mechanisms that you can use to monitor and manage that. What's happened, or what we're seeing, is that the amount of information that you have to monitor in order to do that very effectively is difficult. And so, I mean, the amount of information is huge. And so to effectively pick out an individual piece of information that might be an attack can be very difficult, just because of the amount of false positives that you would have to wade through. So the ability to understand, to monitor, and to really effectively dissect the information that you're watching is critical to knowing who's there and who isn't.
So, Tim, could you tell us a little bit about something I've got written down here? It's called the U.S. Cyber Command. That sounds like a very important thing.
You know, Bill, I'm really not an expert on that. So I know certainly that is the Department of Defense's kind of next wave of defense for cybersecurity, but I'm going to defer on that.
John, can you talk about it?
Well, yeah, I think that the U.S. Cyber Command has been put together to be able to monitor the nation's infrastructure. So if you think about it, the electrical grid, the delivery of power, it's not just the delivery of a network anymore. I bring up the power grid, attacks from outside the country now that are going after trying to bring down a power grid, or trying to bring down a city's network, trying to bring down the government's agencies. That's really what they're going after. So the U.S. Cyber Command is really looking at it from the country perspective, rather than from an individual company's perspective.
It seems like are trying to provide a defensive mechanism to potential cyber war
at some point. Cyber war is the big term now. It's different governments going after each other, trying to bring down their defenses, because if you can't communicate, you can't defend yourself, and that's really what it's coming down to.
So, Tim, I heard you talking a few minutes ago about going into the high schools and all, but it strikes me that finding enough talent to really be effective in cybersecurity must be a real challenge. Can you talk about that and what's being done to get the people that we need to do this work?
Well, I think it's a huge challenge. It's a huge challenge for industry. It's a huge challenge for government. So, it of course starts really in schools. And, one of the things that we know is that our children today are probably more computer literate than the adults. They've grown up with compute devices of every kind. They do things differently with compute devices than we do. I mean, people under the age of 21 typically don't email. They use text. And that's one of the issues, of course, one of the problems that we talked about earlier, we didn't perhaps hit on, was the cultural differences and changes that are coming and the technology inertia that hits government. We have to learn from people that are considerably younger than us about how IT is being used, the innovative ways that people are using it. The whole concept of these flash mobs, example, using social media, you know, is something that, you know, people didn't anticipate a few years back. So when we look at how do we educate people, that's going to be a challenge. It's we're seeing that whole departments are being set up for cybersecurity at colleges and universities. The University of Maryland adult education program has got a whole cybersecurity program now. We're seeing that happen at various universities across the country, there's, you know, a good interchange between government and industry in actually staffing these universities and training up folks today. So it's a problem, but I think one that we've begun to really address, we'll get better at it as time goes on.
And we're talking about technology in the federal government. And to help us with that today, you're listening to John Carney and Tim Simon from Cisco. This is Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hey, it's the Geico Gecko. Now, as a federal employee, you're probably one for a smart presentation, so I've put together some charts and graphs here. There you go. That will help illustrate the money you could save by switching to Geico. First thing you'll notice is that GEICO now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. Now this is big news. But that shouldn't come as any surprise from a car insurance company that has been serving government employees since 1936. And as you can see on this graph here, it's probably why we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. Yeah, no, I do actually realise you can't see these, but trust me, they're rather impressive. Especially the 97% customer satisfaction rate. And when you consider it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more, well, all you GS7 employees or above should just contact GEICO. Tell them, Mike.
Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey, and the Gecko said it best. Most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above, could get a discount on their car insurance. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local GEICO office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford. You're listening to us on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And we're talking to John Carney and Tim Simon of Cisco about technology in the federal government. And we've talked a little bit about general topics and what's going on from the business perspective in the government. We've talked about cybersecurity, which, of course, is a very major, important, ever-growing area. But I'd like to talk about something I hear about on the commercials on Federal News Radio here all the time, and that's cloud computing, because I sort of have an idea what cloud computing is. I know that's where we're going. It's going to be where everybody is here in the not-too-distant future. Tim, could you give me a brief explanation of cloud computing, what it is? Tim, are you still there?
Absolutely. Still here. Can you hear me?
Yep, I hear you. I just wanted to know a little bit about cloud computing.
Sure. So I think, you know, one of the easiest ways to think about cloud computing is to think about things that we all use. You know, in its earliest form, cloud computing is probably, much like our electric grid. It's a shared resource that we all use. If you think of the automatic teller machines that we're all used to using, that's an example of cloud computing. We all bank at different banks, yet there's a shared infrastructure that allows us to withdraw money authenticate and access our information across, you know, a broad network owned by the banking system. In federal government, it's really a way to take advantage of virtualized resources, compute, network, storage, and be able to share the costs administrative burden across, you know, different departments and different agencies. With that, of course, you know, comes different concerns around security, et cetera, but it's the vision of distributed computing, I think, that we all had in the 1960s with mainframes, but the very fast network has made, available to us today, and it really works. That vision has become reality.
So John, tell me a little bit about, is this sort of what you were talking about earlier, doing more with less? Is cloud computing an example of how to do that?
It really is. It's around shared resources. So it's building an infrastructure or building a data center out to support multiple customers, for instance, is a lot cheaper than building 10 of them in different locations.
This is not up in the sky in a cloud somewhere.
This is not up in the sky.
This is actually a piece of electronic equipment that exists in a building someplace.
In a building, in a room that's got to be, you know, air conditioned and has a huge, you know, power consumption footprint. The ability to be able to build one of these environments instead of 10 that everybody can use is one way to do it. The other is to share those resources when you need them. So if there's a company that needs resources or an agency that needs resources more during the day, they can use those resources during the day, and then those resources can be switched over to another agency for overnight work because they have more compute needs in the after hours.
All right. So I've been around the federal government for a little while. I used to work for the government. And one of the things I see that comes up all the time is little turf battles. And a lot of agencies sometimes can tend to be selfish. And like they have their own budget, their own allocation from Congress. And they are not necessarily always interested in sharing with others. How do you get over that?
That's a huge effort that is happening today, and absolutely one that we're trying to help with because it does continue. People, agencies don't like to share because they don't like other people touching their stuff.
But it's more than that. It's like what benefit do I get? Somebody else gets to use this thing that I maybe have helped pay for. I don't get any benefit from that when they're using it. So it's also that.
I think that's a misnomer, and I think that's what we're trying to do. It's an educational issue that we have to show that the shared resources, the shared pool of information, the shared pool of technology is a cheaper way. It brings your costs down. It reduces the amount of management costs. People are looking at it, I think, just from a strict, you know, perspective of what do I have to buy, whereas in reality, you have to buy less. You need less people to run it from your agency when you start to share the resource.
And then there's that other dynamic in government when something goes wrong. Who gets the blame? What if one of these cloud computing centers breaks down and you've got half a dozen agencies that are sharing resources and they then can't be responsive to their customers, they can't do business as they normally do. Who gets the blame?
Well, that's one of the things that we look at around resiliency. When we refer to the resiliency, that's one of the big enablers of cloud. It's easier, you know, I said earlier, you know, we go from 10 to 1. In reality, what you would do is you would go from 10 to 2 maybe and have two different environments that would support all of you out of both environments. So you've got the ability to continue doing your business even if one of the data centers
goes down. Because you've got successful backup and you've got duplication.
Exactly. You've replicated
and
everything. And you know, the fact is that the way the technology is built today, you'd have to take a major outage for it to go down. Now, not to say that it won't happen or couldn't happen, but that's where the backups come in and where your alternate data centers come up.
So Tim, let me ask you, you've got all of this redundancy built in, but then you've got the cybersecurity issue that we talked about earlier, and John was mentioning how the effort is to go after the infrastructure. So how secure are these cloud computing centers from cyber attacks?
Well, you know, I think that's one of the biggest concerns that people have. At the same time, what happens when you begin to look at virtualizing your environment or creating a cloud, one of the things that you do is that you actually take a look at who's going to be part of that cloud. So you begin to define your attack plane and understand who is on the network and be able to then get a better grasp on what the security angle is. One of the things that's also come up over the years, of course, is Homeland Security Presidential Directive 23, you know, which we looked at providing the right access to people and, you know, the common access card. So some of these things are beginning to get built into the networks, and I think that's really helping as we deliver those services today across the cloud. that these technologies that, you know, some smart people thought about, you know, 10, 15 years ago are beginning to, you know, pick up the slack.
So, John, when you you talk about actually having a cloud computing across agencies, is that actually happening today? Multiple agencies participating in cloud computing, or are you pretty much like just seeing it within one agency?
I think today what you're seeing is mostly what we would refer to as a private cloud. And a private cloud is something that is still within the agency, but is they're centralizing the data centers that may have supported different departments within the agency and now running it out of a single cloud. So that's what would be referred to as a private cloud. The public cloud, or more of a hybrid, is the approach that we think we're going to see come out in the future, whereas you'll have some of the technology in a private cloud, some of it in a public cloud. But then also what you'll see is as people get more comfortable with the security, you'll see agents, you know, start to see cross-agency use of the private clouds.
Is there anybody that's coordinating that effort among federal agencies? Because I think that's a real revolutionary way for government to work.
There has been a directive that's come down to start to move to the cloud environment. So you are starting to see agencies move and start to adopt the clouds. I don't remember which one it is off the top of my head, but yeah, they're starting to see more of it and starting to adopt it. I think the cross agency is the part that the next hurdle we have to get over.
So, Tim, I've heard you and John use the term virtualization a few times. Could you explain that a little bit more to me, what that means, virtualizing?
Sure. So it's the ability to create resources inside a computer that are that replicate quickly and provision quickly services that we need. So if you think of, a large hard disk drive, for instance, on a computer, that can be sliced up into many different shares, if you will, or folders. And it's the ability to then use the network to serve up those resources from one machine to many different people. So you might, for instance, there's a big initiative right now called desktop virtualization, and that's where folks are actually using the cloud or a virtualized compute center to deliver a desktop experience to people across the network. So they're really using a server to provide the look and feel of a desktop and actually saving the cost of having a very expensive piece of hardware on their desk. But more importantly, perhaps, not even that so much as the agency gets to control the environment, the software, the delivery, and the configuration management so that it's a more secure environment, it's a more common environment for folks, and it can be delivered on the fly so that when you get a new employee, you can quickly provision that resource out to the individual. You were asking something else though earlier, and I thought it was kind of interesting around, will agencies respond, or, you know, what's the payoff around, letting people use my resources? And I was thinking of an example in local government and in the school systems where we had a customer that supplied virtualized IT resources to 37 school districts. And they started by supplying voice dial tone to these schools. And they allowed the schools to have both the public telephone system and the IP voice telephone at the same time. Well, quickly the schools decided that the IP voice system was much less expensive and more resilient, so they opted for the cloud service for telephone service. Then what happened is that they realized that because this was an IT-based service, that they could provide desktop virtualization to students on the very same platform. So there actually was a big performance gain by the end users to be able to use virtualized resources as opposed to having separate systems that they all owned.
Yeah, it does seem like, and I asked John to answer this question, it does seem like at least the private clouds that you talked about, it seems like agencies should be going to that. Do you find most are going to a private cloud computing?
I think that's what we're seeing at the moment, certainly in the government. I think the one thing that the one point that I wanted to make around clouds, though, that to your point earlier, is that in a cloud, you're able to compartmentalize your resources. So you can create an environment within the cloud that you can define exactly who has access to it and how they get access to it. So you don't have to worry about other people within your cloud getting to your resources.
And that's all ties into the cybersecurity issue, and it lays a really nice groundwork for what we're going to talk about when we come back from the break, which is teleworking. And Tim, we'll let you lead off that discussion since you have 14 years of experience as a telecommuter. This is Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be right back.
It's the Geico Gecko with a little hello to all you federal employees. Now, in government, there are people on all points of the political spectrum, but there is one thing that everyone agrees on. Saving money is good. Which brings me to the big news. Geico now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. It don't matter if you're a Democrat or an aristocrat, left wing, right wing, or a chicken wing. If you're a federal employee GS7 or above, you could be saving a lot of money on your car insurance by switching to Geico. So no matter if you're blue or red or, in my case, green. If you're a federal employee, GS7 or above, contact Geico and see how much you could save. Isn't that right, Mike?
Exactly right, my little green friend. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. And like the Gecko said, discounts are available for most federal employees, GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. We're talking about technology in the federal government with our two very knowledgeable guests, John Carney and Tim Simon from Cisco. So we've laid this groundwork with cybersecurity, a big issue, cloud computing. We now have an idea what that is and how we're moving toward that. And of course, the big thing, the big change that means a lot to me. I've been a part of helping to roll out the government policy on it is the teleworking environment that is a bigger deal now in the federal government than it used to be. There's an expectation that every agency have a telework policy, a telework coordinator. There's a lot more that's involved in this. And of course, Tim, a major part of being able to telework effectively is technology. So with your 14 years of experience, why don't you talk a little bit about how technology works and makes telework possible?
Well, you know, it's been a great ride. I can remember, I think it was in 97, you know, I started teleworking and I lived in the Washington area. I lived in just a little bit south of Frederick, Maryland, and my office was in Rockville, and I used to dread the drive on 270 every day, and I only had a short ride. I wasn't even going into the district. So,
and that was 14 years ago. It's worse today.
Yeah, it is. But all of a sudden, somebody gave me a laptop at work, and they said, "Oh, here's a cyber key you can use if you're dialing in." And I didn't even, you know. And I thought, "Well, what's that?" They said, "Oh, well, you can dial in and get your virtual resources through the system, and it'll encrypt stuff." So you can work from home if you want. And I thought, wow. So I started trying that. And it was at that time, I would telecommute maybe 2 or 3 days a week, and I had to plan a little bit around it, and I would make sure that I had things loaded on my laptop, et cetera, and bring disks with me or CDs with me, and I would have everything I needed and then just work over telephone. And it was sometimes slow, and then all of a sudden I got ISDN. Well, ISDN all of a sudden, just was – wonderful because I could, everything was fast. It was almost like being in the office. Not quite, but pretty good. And then, a few years later, I got cable. And a cable made all the difference in the world because, everything, I truly had an office kind of IT experience in my home office. And I was getting so much more done. I wasn't commuting. I was up to, and by the time I got cable, actually even at the tail end of ISDN, I was full-time telecommuting. What's really driven things for me, though, is has been video. In fact, you know, during this time, I moved from the Washington, D.C. area to Florida. And I remember talking to my boss, and I said, you know, I drive into Falls Church from Frederick. I said, you know, when the VP has a meeting, I said, it takes me 2.5 hours sometimes. I said, you know, I can get there from Florida in that time. And my boss was a pretty forward-thinking person. He says, I don't care where you live, as long as you can get there when you need to be there. If you have to be at a meeting, you know, it's okay. And so I moved to Florida. You know, for 3 years, nobody knew that I still have my 301 area code telephone on my cell phone. Nobody knew that I lived in Florida because I was still making my meetings and doing what I needed to do. And when there was a conference or whatever, I needed to be in Washington, I just came up. But, you know, my personal life was so much better. My cost of living went down. My wife was able to stay home with our kids. It was just a tremendous experience for us because we were able to take advantage of a lower cost living area. My job didn't suffer at all. And now I had video. So I have, you know, today when I get on conference calls with folks, I use either video, you know, regular high-end video, or I use our WebEx video and our collaboration tools, and I don't miss a beat. In fact, sometimes live meetings are not as productive for me as teleconference meetings with WebEx because I have all the IT tools right at my fingertips when I'm in a virtual meeting. And so, you know, I just love telecommuting. I think it has I cannot imagine going to an office every day ever again. If I have to do that, I'm sure I could, but I get so much more done. I don't have any commute time, and I can work, you know, if there's something that I need to do in my own personal life, you know, the culture of Cisco trusts me to get my job done, and I can arrange my schedule. I know that cultural issues in terms of management are somewhat different sometimes in government versus private companies, but, you know, I know most of the people that I work with in government are driven by the same kind of objectives that we are in industry. So I think it's, you know, something that's just going to be a life changer for government employees. And I think, you know, the good news for citizens is that, you know, the next big snowstorm in D.C., we won't have Snowmageddon. You know, the government will still, you know, be functioning. As citizens, we'll still be able to get citizen services. Just people won't be, you know, sitting in their office downtown. Yeah. They'll be at their home.
I think that's true to some extent. I don't know if it'll be true 100% just yet. We're working toward that. But tell me, John, how do you get this? All that technology sounds really good, but how do you get that in the hands of every federal employee who wants to telework? It sounds expensive.
Well, the costs have come down significantly. As long as there's a connection to the home, the infrastructure is not so bad. I have a similar environment in my house, so I have the same telephone at home that I would have sitting at my desk at work. I have the same PC I would have sitting at my desk at work, and I have, you know, the same printer that I would have sitting on my desk. I just have it sitting at home, and in addition to that, I have a VPN router that connects back to the infrastructure. So when I'm sitting at home, you can't tell where I'm located based on the number that I call. So the only difference in cost per employee is, you know, maybe a $1,000 router at their house that they would have instead of all of the equipment in the office. And the way you offset that, or the way you look at that, is that look at the amount of money that I'm saving from a real estate perspective. I don't have to have a space for all of those people to sit in the office anymore. I don't have building space that I have to lease. It gets the people off the road. I don't have to commute anymore. It actually makes them more productive. So the infrastructure back on the other end, there's a cost involved to that. But I really believe that the costs are more than offset by the increased productivity.
So this $1,000 router, does that also include how you get on the internet, your internet access? Is that
well? That well. So
and how do you do that?
Well, you've got a cable TV that comes into your house, and or you've got VPN, or I'm sorry, you know, Verizon or Comcast or somebody will deliver the internet connectivity into your house. And as long as you have the internet connectivity, and most families, you know, have it today.
So you're talking about your personal internet access, and it's sort of like if you wanted to telework, then you'd have to use your personal internet access with government equipment.
Exactly. And actually, you can do it today with your laptop. And this is typically what people will do is Comcast will deliver a wireless connection in their house. They'll bring their laptop home. They'll connect to the wireless access, and then they'll bring up a VPN on their laptop, which we would refer to as a software virtual private network, which connects back to their data center and allows them to
just like they're at work.
Just like they're at work. And taking the hardware router just increases the flexibility of what you can do. So it makes it easier to deliver phone services. It provides what we call an always-on connection.
And so, Tim, what are the security implications of all that? I mean, it seems like if you can go all these different places, it would be easier for someone to come into that infrastructure, into that network at the agency that perhaps should not be there? Or is that pretty well taken care of with all the cybersecurity that's out there?
Well, you know, the number one thing that we know about security is that the most important thing is training people. It's not technology. So if I leave my laptop logged on without appropriate security measures, and you know I don't have a that it doesn't go to a screensaver or a screen lock, sure, somebody I guess could see data, but that would be the case if I left it at my office desk, etc. So you have to train people appropriately.
It's a change in the way.
So do you find, John, that agencies are, now that this telework legislation has passed and OPM has some rules on it, that you see more and more people actually moving to getting the technology to allow telework?
I think that we're starting to see it. I think that the policies, like Tim said, it's creating the right policies and then being able to enforce the policies. And I think that we're getting better at being able to enforce those policies on the remote workers. And I think that that's the comfort level that we need to get to before we're going to start to see a wide adoption of that.
All right. We have just over a minute left. So the one last topic I want to mention is the tablets, the iPads. I see more and more of those all around with government employees as they go to meetings. Is that making it easier to do all of this telework and to actually get on the internet? Do you see that as the next thing that's out there?
It's certainly making it easier for the users. It's making it considerably more difficult for the IT staff, the security around the bring your own device to work.
And what about a government issued iPad?
I think a government issued iPad, I think that is something. Tablets in government is something that's been a big topic these days. And I do think that those devices with the technology and the virtualization of the desktop are really going to make a difference in the future.
And make it a government more efficient and
it
cheaper?
Absolutely will make it more efficient.
Do you see extra security issues with tablets?
It's a different security model. It's that you have to adapt. You have to adapt your policies. They're going to change a little bit. But I don't think it changes the fact that we have to make the users as aware of it as we do anyway.
Okay. We are just about out of time here on Fed Talk. Tim Simon from Cisco, thank you very much for being here from your remote location in Florida. And John Carney, also coming down from Philadelphia to be here in the studio. Very, very interesting. And you made, a tough topic, technology in the government, understandable. And that's all the time we have today for Fed Talk. Thank you all for being with us. Have a great weekend.